among the last six picks taken. A familiar name if you're a college football fan. Tom Brady, the quarterback who all he did was lead this football team, put them in the right position more times than not. And when he got pulled from the game and Drew Henson came in, Michigan football was not as good as it was when Brady was in.
Yeah, happy 20th anniversary. I am older and I had hair. I hear that every April 16th. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Lunch Talk Live here on NBCSN. Mike Tirico with you. We are available for you on podcast form if you don't catch the show live at noon Eastern or the re-air at 3 Eastern after Rich Eisen's show is on from 1 to 3 Eastern time on TV. Catch us on podcast anytime. And there are good guests to catch as well. If you don't catch us, by the way, the YouTube channel for NBC Sports has the show as well. We're going to speak today with Ahmad Rashad about Michael Jordan and his great career. Ahmad's, not just Michael's. Kia Tomlin, the wife of Mike Tomlin, the Pittsburgh Steelers head coach. She is very involved in something that's very important to all of us right now. That's protecting everyone from spreading COVID-19. Roger Penske, the captain, one of the great leaders in all of sport and business, will join us. And David Bedaya, the Olympic diver. So a full plate. Let's start with one of our NBC Sports teammates, colleagues, and friends. Michelle Tafoya joins us from someplace that looks much warmer than where I am right now. Michelle, how are you and the family holding up here in week five of quarantine?
You know, so far, so good. Thank goodness for Zoom online education. You know, that's what we're engrossed in right now.
Yeah, with the kids and all of us are doing a little bit of that. So, Michelle, you saw the top of the show where we just talked about Tom Brady being drafted 20 years ago today. It's hard to believe that whole stretch of Brady drafted, sixth round. He's used that pick 199 as motivation. And now we're into the last chapter in all likelihood in football and Tom Brady in Tampa. It's hard to believe it's been 20 plus years that we've had Tom Brady, the quarterback, to discuss and look back at over these years.
It really is. And watching him through so many different parts of his life, too, you know, with his, I mean, his personal life has been very public as well, having his first child and then marrying Giselle and having more children. And by the way, one of the reasons I'm sitting outside, Mike, is because of some advice that Tom Brady gave me a couple of years ago. He said that his wife, Giselle, said the two most important things in life are timing and lighting. And as a model, she should know that. And Tom's taking it to heart, and I am too. I think the light's better out here. But it is amazing that it's been two decades, isn't it? It really is. And sixth round and all the rest.
I just sent you a picture of my setup. I actually bought a light here for the house, a studio light. Al Roker on Instagram this morning showed that he has a new backlight and a new setup for his at home. So it's all of us becoming really, really amateur lighting directors. But you have the best light, the natural light down there. So I got to embarrass myself by showing the 20 years ago me at the draft. I got a chance to watch Michelle Tafoya from a few years ago on TV last night on NBCSN. We're doing this Olympic week in America, and it's fun to look back. And last night was Rio and the swimming, which meant one thing. It was, well, two things. It was a lot of Katie Ledecky and then a lot of Michael Phelps in his last run at the Olympics. And after he gets out of the pool, seconds later, you are there on the pool deck in that mix zone doing those interviews. Can you take us there? What were those like as he keeps coming out of the pool and talking about history, his own history that he keeps adding on to time and time again?
Well, one of the things that first comes to mind, Mike, was how accessible he was and that he would wait around for the interviews. If we couldn't get to him immediately, he would stand there and wait, and he was patient. So I want to get that out there first, because that's not something you can talk about in a live interview. He was terrifically accessible. That wasn't even like going to work for me. I would walk out of that building every night and go, I can't believe I get to do this. It felt historical. It was historical. It was chilling. The fans' reaction to him was tingling. It just would, you know, it would set your goosebumps alight. And having his son there, Boomer, wearing the little headphones, and just all of it, and how much his teammates really rallied around him as well. It was, I'll never forget it. It was one of my best experiences covering sports.
It's fun to watch these going back. Olympic Week in America continues on NBCSN all this week and then more next week as well. It's great to relive some of those. We don't have Tokyo. We would be 99 days from the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games in Tokyo if it was still on schedule, but obviously pushed back to 2021. Michelle, you have spoken to a couple of college classes. People ask you all the time, and you are so great and giving with advice to people who want to get into the business. I'm just curious, as someone who's in the booth or at a courtside table for a lot of those moments, I've seen you after Super Bowls, after NBA championships with Kevin Garnett, the Phelps moments. You get these athletes right after they have accomplished something big or finished a big game. What is the key ingredient or two that you use to get their emotion in an interview when their minds have been going 100 different directions for the last few hours?
Once you ask the question, the first question, shut up and let them talk and do not interrupt if at all possible, because what you're seeing is unbridled emotion, like you said. And some of the best answers come out of this, some of the most authentic stuff, like Kevin Garnett or Katie Ledecky telling me she almost threw up in the pool swimming the 200 because, you know, she's not used to sprints as much. But, you know, all those kinds of things, you just really have to let them talk. But you also have to set them up properly, I think. And the fun thing about the Olympics and where and any of those really is you're talking to someone who's victorious. They're about as happy as they're going to be in life professionally in that moment. And it's such a joy and such a privilege to be able to share that moment or with the viewers and let them see it and to just kind of try to, I don't know, you just sort of try to set it on the right stage and your question starts to become that stage, how you ask it, what you ask. And so I don't know, it's taken a lot of time and experience to whittle down questions to make sure you get that right essence of the moment. And usually the simpler the question, the better.
Yeah, and you crush it when you do that. Every time you leave the microphone there for another extra second or two, I'm like, boy, I would have pulled the microphone back. That's why Michelle's so great. She leaves it there and gets that emotion and lets the person keep expanding. I'm so jealous that that you have that talent. All right, we want to get back to me calling games and in the studio and you doing those interviews. And we all want to know when that's going to be. And we all know that nobody knows. But the answer man for the last 6 weeks or so has been Dr. Anthony Fauci. He had this quote. I want to share this with everyone and get your reaction to it, Michelle, about when can we get back to the games? When can we get back to sports? And Dr. Fauci said, there's a way of doing things. This was on a really interesting series of interviews with Peter Hamby of Snapchat running all week. Nobody comes to the stadium, put the players in the hotels, whatever, to play, keep them well surveilled, have them tested every single week, make sure they don't wind up infecting each other or their families, and then let the season go on. That sounds good. We talked yesterday to Mike Trout of the Angels about that, and the players are like, that's going to be a little difficult to be stuck in a hotel for months. How do you think our jobs covering these games might be different if we get to that world, Michelle, where the players are sequestered somewhere and we're waiting to keep everybody healthy, but at the same time, having games without fans?
Yeah, it is interesting, and I know different players have different reactions to playing without fans. I think it would be kind of intriguing for a season to see how that looks. The television fans are just as much fans as those paying to be in the buildings, and they want to see football. For us, I think I was talking to Fred Godelli, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football the other day. We were trying to picture how preparation for the telecast would look. And it would look a lot like the discussion you and I are having right now. I think interviews with the coach and the players would probably be done, you know, virtually like this. That would be our preparation. And I do think the testing, once that becomes widespread, that is going to be an integral part of all of this, of whether or not we can be around the athletes, of whether or not we can be around each other in the building. It is hard to think about the athletes being sequestered in hotel rooms. I kind of understood that to mean, okay, the Patriots get to site in Buffalo and they stay in their hotel all the while until they get to the game. That's what I understood. And then they can go home and go to their families. But maybe I'm wrong about that. I think, you know, the other part of it is teams may not come in the night before the way they used to, Mike. You know, they usually we wait for them on the Saturday before the Sunday game and meet them at their hotels. Maybe they come in Sunday mornings. Yeah, yeah. They get all their stuff done and then just come in Sunday mornings, play the games, and get out of Dodge.
A lot of different scenarios. And, you know, I think football is unique because of the once-a-week nature of it. With baseball or basketball or hockey, where you're talking about playing the multiple games, especially as the latter two, the winter sports, quote-unquote, be getting towards playoffs, you'd be in those situations where you'd be playing every couple of days. So there are so many different paths, and there's no final answer. There's a plan, but at least Dr. Fauci gave a lot of sports fans a window on maybe this can happen somewhere down the line. So you are obviously so close to Minneapolis, spending so much time living there, and Kirk Cousins said it would be refreshing to play a game or two or some portion of a season without fans. It's been a newsworthy offseason here with the Vikings. Stephon Diggs traded to Buffalo. We're hearing this Odell Beckham Jr. rumor come up, and that's draft week conversation as per usual. Those things come up. Some live, some don't. What's your read on the Vikings offseason so far, Michelle?
Well, you know, the Stephon Diggs thing didn't totally surprise me because it seemed he was not happy in Minnesota. In spite of all the successes he had had there, it just seemed like he and Cousins and the coaching staff were not on the same page. And I don't know who's to blame for that, but it's, to me, the game is about team, not about me. And so I'm not sure where that broke down. But given that, yes, they need the Vikings a wide receiver of that ilk. Whether or not they can afford Odell Beckham Jr.'s contract in the long run, really, I don't know. They would have to make some room for that, and I'm not sure where they make it. So that one's intriguing. But you know as well as I do, Mike, that these are the kinds of rumors that circulate a week before the draft to get teams to reposition or rethink what they're going to do. And I've spent so many years trying to predict how the draft is going to go and being proven a fool every time, because there are just so many variables and so many moves to be made. So I'm just going to sit back and watch it and kind of enjoy it and take notes along the way.
I'm right there with you. Having been, as we both have been, covering drafts over the years, you're in the middle of the disinformation system where you pass things along. And that's not to say that one rumor or this rumor is a bad one. It just becomes the nature of the beast. And it is nice to just sit back and let the whole thing play out and then assess it and go forward. Lastly, as we wrap up here, Michelle, you talked about the Vikings in general. This is a really intriguing NFC. You think about Breeze and the Saints, a team that was close. The Vikings, who knocked them out, who were close. Add Brady to the mix in the NFC South. Philadelphia would try to come back healthy. When you start to think about football and think about the on the field, the 49ers made it to the Super Bowl as the champs. Right. The NFC has so many different storylines as we look forward to this year.
And that's one of the reasons I hope we can look forward to this year, Mike. It seems cyclical to me. Some years the AFC is where the stories are, with Denver and Indy and New England and Kansas City. But the NFC has gotten some of its power back, some of that old power back that we used to enjoy with the old 49ers and the old Dallas Cowboys and all the rest. So it is really intriguing. And most of all, people are going to really want to see what happens in Tampa Bay with Tom Brady. But I fingers crossed, because it could be a really fun season. Crowds or no crowds, I would really be interested to see a poll of the fans out there if they would be into watching games on TV only and if that would be enough for them.
Yeah, I think if you ask everybody right now, they'll say absolutely, because we're kind of running out of things to go back and show. So Michelle wins for the backdrop and for the content and for what she's able to share with us. Thanks, Michelle. Great catching up. Best of the family. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, MT. See ya.
CMT, Michelle Tafoya joining us as we continue. Ahmad Rashad, there's a lot of talk about Michael Jordan and the documentary that's coming out to document his life. Nobody had a better front row shot of that than Ahmad. Ahmad Rashad joins us as we continue. Well, we mentioned sports without fans when speaking with Michelle earlier as a way to restart, and that is where The PGA Tour is setting its sights, announced a couple of hours ago. The tour plans on playing 8 events, starting with the Charles Schwab Challenge in Texas, before the PGA Championship, which is run by the PGA of America. But you get some of the notable events in that stretch. Of course, our friends at golfchannel.com have all the coverage on that. So the first 4 events for now are scheduled without spectators: the RBC Heritage, the Travelers Championship just outside of Hartford, and the Rocket Mortgage Tournament in Detroit. So those 4 are scheduled without fans. Then the hope is to have fans sometime after the 4th of July and then get back. But obviously, there's a caveat to all of this, and the PGA Tour has said that in their statement, that we'll make sure that things are right with the municipalities, and if things change, the schedule can change. But at least that is some sports back on the calendar, at least in the planning phases for now. Golf making the most sense, and there are a little more than half the states in the country where individuals can go out and play golf as long as they stay socially distanced. If there is the chance to play golf and it's legally allowed in a state or any state, there's little doubt Ahmad Rashad is not too far away. Ahmad Rashad, over the years, who you knew from the University of Oregon, who you knew from NBC, who worked with me at ABC and ESPN, who has been around sports for half a century. Nobody loves golf more than Ahmad, who did a stint on Golf Channel. Are you in a place where you can play golf, Ahmad?
No, I am not. I can putt in my backyard as long as I stay away from my wife or my daughter. So it's just me and my dog putting. But no, you can't. No, I think the next county up, Martin County, you can play.
Okay. All right. So if you see Ahmad coming to your county, you understand what it is. What has it been for you over the years, your love of the sport of golf? Because you have really been one of those people who's fallen in love with the game over the last 20, 30 years.
You know, I realize it's probably the best sport that I've ever attempted to play because it's personal. Everybody has their own personal demons that they have to sort of work through. And it's also a game that the best can play with the worst. You can always get shots. And it doesn't hurt to have one of the game's greatest players be one of your best friends that'll play with you whenever you want. And that's Tiger Woods. So that's a lot of fun. But it's a game you can play forever. It's, you know, you can play as you're young and as you get older, it becomes more and more about more than golf. And I honestly, like I said before, I think it's the best game in the world.
We're going to ask you about Michael here in a little bit because of the documentary that's coming up. But you mentioned Tiger, being close with him, and obviously your friendship with Michael Jordan over the years. What do you see similar in both of those guys that has made them the, in many cases, a lot of folks believe the greatest in their individual sports over time?
That is a great question. What I see in these two guys is their quest for excellence. And nobody determines what that excellence is except them. They're competing with themselves. They're trying to be the best they can possibly be, and they have never set any sort of limits. You know, when people say the sky's the limit, well, their limit is past that. And they work extremely hard to get to where they want to be. And it's one of the things about both of them is I'm talking about workouts. They are just fanatical. You know, when Michael was playing, he never missed a workout. Mm. He worked harder than anybody I'd ever seen. And me being an athlete myself and having seen sort of the things that people put themselves through to get ready, prepared to play. These two guys, I've never seen anybody be more dedicated than them. Tiger, you know, the other day I'm talking to him, it's 5:30 in the morning, he just came from working out. You know, or hey, dude, what are you doing, man? I'm sweating my ass off. I just came out of the gym. You know, and you're thinking, it's like it's 5:30 a.m. So it's the drive. It's the will to be the best. It's just... you know, it's one of those things that sports is all about. You just you want to try to be the best you can possibly be. And now who's going to sit down and go, oh, you know what? I'm going to do whatever it takes to be the best I can be. Those two guys are two examples that have done that.
And you brought up a really interesting point because there's it's like John Madden. There's a generation or two that didn't know that Madden coached. There's a whole generation of folks who have seen you on TV and on Inside Stuff back in the 90s and all that, who didn't know Bobby Moore, the receiver at Oregon, who was in the College Football Hall of Fame, or know the guy who was in the Ring of Honor with the Minnesota Vikings and had some really good years. Did you see any athletes when you were doing that, or that internal drive that you had, that could compare to where Tiger and Jordan have taken their mental and physical combination?
There were, and you said it perfectly, because it's not just physical. It's also mental. It's a way that they, very few people that I've ever met or ever been around that have the natural born talent, but the wherewithal to find the whatever it is inside of them that makes them want to excel, that cannot take being second ever. You know, just, it's just not a part of who they are. And to try to keep up with them is almost impossible. But they sort of lead by doing. And I guess when we talk about Michael, we'll talk more about that. But no, these two guys, these are guys that, you're talking about workaholics. You know, you see some people that work so hard and they go, you know, the guy made the team because he worked so hard. Well, here's two guys that were the best that have ever done it that worked twice as hard as they did.
We're talking about Michael Jordan. The documentary that ESPN's going to run is going to start running here. I think a lot of us who are sports fans and were anywhere near a TV or around those teams a little bit are excited to see it. So, Ahmad, the whole deal with the Gatorade commercial was be like Mike, right? What was it like to be around Mike during those times?
It wasn't just Michael, but the Chicago Bulls were like the Beatles. I mean, if you can imagine what that was like, that no matter where they went, there was always a huge following. The hotels were full of people. The cars were full of all kinds of, you know, wherever you went, you'd find people everywhere. My relationship with Michael was sort of different, is because when NBC, we had just lost football and we just got basketball. And so in order to do basketball, there was a situation where I had with David Stern to do a show called Inside Stuff. That was going to be our, NBC is going to be our foray into the NBA. And I was going to be the host of that. So I needed to get myself out and sort of get people used to, this was at a point when people knew I was a football player and they knew I did football at that point. So this was the point of me trying to establish myself as also a basketball fan and a basketball reporter. So Michael, Magic Johnson had this game in the summertime called Summers something. It was an all-star game where all the guys in the league would come out and stay in LA for 3 or 4 days and they'd play in an all-star game. And so NBC was going to televise that, you know, for our sort of jump off into the NBA. So I went out there, and before I went out there, here's something that's pretty interesting. Before I went out there, now the guy that really got me into Michael Jordan in terms of a player was John McEnroe. Now, John McEnroe is a huge basketball fan. I mean, huge, huge, huge. And we talked on the phone all the time. Yeah, we talked on the phone all the time about this and that and the other. And he'd go, hey, have you seen this Michael Jordan guy at North Carolina? I went, yeah, I've seen him a couple of times. He said, well, we got to watch him. So for the next few weeks and up till, I think, 82 when they won the championship, we would watch the games, you know. And all of a sudden I got, man, this guy's really good. And then went away. You know, I'm not went away, but I was always a fan after that and watching and the whole thing. So now I go to this All-Star game as NBC starting to do it. And Michael and I meet. We shake hands and we meet and we talk for a little while. Hey, what's up? Da-da-da-da. And there's kind of something between us that's you know, it's like when you and I met, there was something between us that, you know what, hey, pretty cool dude. What's up, man? How you doing? How's everything? I'm a big fan of yours. Exactly. It was sort of things like that. That's what happened between him and I. And from that day on, we changed numbers. It was in the summer of whatever that was. We changed numbers and almost a week didn't go by that we weren't on the phone saying, how you doing? What's going on? Talking about everything but basketball. Basketball was never the first thing that we always talked about. We just talked about normal stuff, music, clothes, shoes, just normal stuff that guys would sort of talk about. And that's where our relationship sort of started. Now, also during that time, there was only one game of the week. There weren't, you know, doubleheaders. There weren't every team playing every day of the week. There was one game on Sunday, and that was the big game. And we also had inside stuff. Now, Michael and I had become friends at that point, so I could get him to do inside stuff whenever I wanted, which was on his rise up to being the greatest in the world. I think a lot of people looked at it as like, that's not fair. There's no way Ahmad must be just sucking up in there. But it wasn't any of that at all. It was just like, hey, dude, you know, can you come do this thing with me tomorrow? Yeah, no problem. We'll do it. So that relationship sort of grew that way. But as the Bulls got better and better and NBC had them on every Sunday and they had that access with me, it was just natural that you look at it this way. At the end of the game on Sunday, my job was to talk to the best player in that game. Well, every week it was always him. It was always him. Yeah, and so when you look back for it, you know, every time they were on the TV, like if they were playing in Chicago, I'd go to Chicago on Saturday night. I'd spend the night at the house with him and his family, the whole thing. We'd ride to the games together. I'd go do the television. He'd do the game. I'd introduce him after the game. And that's kind of the way it went. And that's the way our sort of relationship went. And then we ended up doing all kinds of stuff.
No, it's great. Hey, we only have 30 seconds. I know you're still close with Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner. Yeah. What's your read on where we are in getting a basketball season finished this year, how important it is to the folks in the league?
I think it's extremely important for them to try to get something done by the end of this year, but not to the point of risking anything or rushing. Adam has proven himself to be one of the finest commissioners of all time, and he will do the right thing in terms of when and how to bring this thing back to fruition and keep it going with the safety of everybody being the most important thing.
All-time pro, you tell Ahmad 30 seconds, he still gives you 29. He's as good as it gets. Hey, it is great to see you. It's great to catch up again. Thanks for the stories. I know you got 100 stories, and we look forward to hearing a bunch of them, and we'll catch up soon. We'll be in touch. Thanks, man.
Mike, always good to see you. Much love, brother.
Same here. Ahmad Rashad, great to catch up with a good friend. So an NFL head coach's wife is helping keep people safe. Tia Tomlin's story when we come back. She joins. Well, ways of life are changing, and one of the ways of life is that we have seen people go from the medical personnel and the frontline folks wearing masks to more wearing masks, including Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York yesterday stating that the state is requiring people to wear masks in public whenever social distancing is not possible. So there's obviously more need for, if you will, civilian masks. And stepping into that breach have been a lot of folks who are helping to design masks, who have turned different parts of their world, their industry, into mask making. And one of the people doing that is Kia Tomlin, who, just for perspective, is the wife of Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin. She joins us now live, but I don't want to talk about Mike Tomlin. I don't want to talk about Steelers and all that stuff. I want to talk about you. Let's give everyone the background first. You have a clothing company that really has adapted to the times and the masks. So tell us about the company and how that got started first, Kia.
So my company is just called Kia Tomlin, and it is just comfortable, polished clothing for the modern women. People like myself that are on the go, raising kids, running a business. And we want to be comfortable, but at the same time, we want to be polished and fashionable. And so that's what I design. And I've had the line since 2014. Fall of 2014 was when I started ready to wear. But previously, I was a custom designer for a number of years, probably close to 20 years now, doing wedding gowns, evening wear, special occasions type stuff.
I was doing a little research on this morning, and I believe the anecdote that you told was your mom would pick you up after a half a day of kindergarten, and you would sit there and start cutting out little fashion-type things from paper, and anything that was around your house, even with your brothers growing up, you would turn into a fashion project. Does that kind of say where the love came from for you?
Yes. Yes, I started very young, and didn't go to design school initially, but in our roundabout travels was able to go actually at when Mike was working at the University of Cincinnati.
So now we get to this reality of what's happening with COVID-19 and the business part of the of your world closes down. So when did you get the idea to adapt your business to help folks who are in need of masks right now?
I was probably about a week into being closed down after kind of the novelty and fun of not working kind of wore off. When, you know, the first few days, it was kind of like a little bit of a vacation being home. And I, someone sent me a text of a request from a hospital system in Indiana, I believe, that was asking for home sewers to help sew masks, that they were really needed masks. And so I was like, oh, this is something that we could do. I've got a team of small team of sewers that are all sitting at home. Still, you know, I was still paying them. And so I figured, let me see if I can, you know, if anyone in our area needs masks. And I called around and got connected with Allegheny Health Network. And so we started sewing and donating masks to the healthcare system.
So how long does it take to make a mask, and how many is your team able to crank out in a week, let's say?
Okay, so it takes about 8 minutes to make a mask. When I set out to donate, my goal was to donate 500 a week. The need has been so great, we're actually doing about 400 a day from our homes, which is not quite as efficient as our workshop, because we're all on home machines as opposed to our industrial machines, which are much faster and more powerful. So yeah, we're putting in some really long days behind the sewing machines.
And did I read right that you're looking to see if there's anybody out there who can find a place or find a substance to be a filter so people can reuse your mask, not in the medical setting, but in the everyday setting, and then they can get something to put in there to be more of a barrier to help out, make it even more protective mask?
Yeah, when I first started doing the mask and I was communicating with Allegheny Health Network and trying to decide, we really didn't know anything about masks. I think like the rest of the country, you kind of hear about these N95s please sew. And so I jump in going, okay, I'm going to make a mask, and quickly realize you cannot make an N95. There's really no substitute for it. And so we kind of, you know, decided on with the CDC compliant version of, you know, a suitable mask with a double layer cotton. But I kept hearing all this talk about filters and will there be a pocket for filters? And we had even kind of, you know, discussed doing that. But where are the filters? Everyone keeps talking about these filters. I don't know what these, I haven't seen a filter come up that would be like a sheet of something that you could insert. So that's what I'm, thinking, like, somebody needs to make the filters.
That's right. That industry coming together, that's what a lot of this is all about. So you mentioned, that you were thinking maybe 500 a day, and now you're cranking out 400 or 500 in a week, and now your team is cranking out 400 in a day. Are you working coaches' hours? Are you working some Mike Tomlin-type hours to get this all done?
I definitely am, and I think he's enjoying watching me do it.
What kind of hours are you working?
Usually to bed by 3 or 4 in the morning and then back up at 7. It doesn't take me from quite that long, but I still, do have to cook and clean, and I've got a house full of people, and I'm the grocery store runner, and, so there's still other things that I'm doing, but I'm putting in, quite a bit of time. I mean, if you're digging over 100 masks a day at 8 minutes a piece, it's a decent amount of time.
So I don't know if you've ever told Mike at any point, hey, put the clicker down and just come over here and help make some masks. How would Coach Tomlin do on a sewing machine?
Horribly, but he did try on the very first mask for fit purposes, and he does like to kind of sleep or nap near the sewing machine. He likes the whiz of the sewing machine.
That's pretty cool. And you have a son who's playing college football. So he's a freshman, and you have another kid who's a high school senior. So like a lot of us, you're readjusting to having everybody under one roof and people who have newly gained independence. So it's a unique challenge there as well. Plus Mike's preparing for the draft. So what is it like trying to keep all this together in the house right now?
Well, I'll have to say, fortunately, since all the kids are older, we've got four at home, my three plus our nephew. They're all older, so they're all in online school and they're pretty self-sufficient. Really, the only inconvenience I would say to me is to have that many like grown people hungry and making messes. Yes, right. Other than that, yeah, it's been smooth sailing. And it's actually kind of been interesting for me to kind of overhear the draft meetings because I don't really follow football that closely. So to hear, you know, the intricacies of what they're, you know, what they're doing is pretty entertaining to me.
So now you understand all those hours at work, what Mike's actually doing, right?
Yeah, I always used to tease him and say that I thought he just office hopped and told jokes and old football stories, but it looks like he's working.
That's so good. Well, thank you for what you're doing. It's really interesting. And then after this, folks should check out the clothing line. It's really neat stuff and a great story. Other than passing by at league meetings or league functions to say hi, we haven't had the chance to connect, but I really appreciate you coming on and great that we could give a little bit of a window to everyone for all that you are doing for your community and to keep people safe. Kia, thank you. Best to your family.
Thank you.
Kia Tomlin, wife of Pittsburgh Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin, is doing some great work. Roger Penske, the captain, he joins us, one of the great leaders of industry in sports and beyond. His perspective as we continue on.
Nothing can stop him.
Let's give them what they came to see. This is going to be a shootout from the end.
They've been swapping the lead lap after lap.
He's coming to you. Playing the game.
At your gearbox.
Simon Pagenaud takes the lead.
Bring her home.
We just put the 500.
In the month of May, he's put it all together to wrangle the points lead away.
We did it!
Nothing else matters here except winning.
That was last year at the Indy 500, one of 18 times that a Team Penske driver has won the Indy 500. One of the over 500 races over many disciplines and 37 championships won by Team Penske drivers, and that all ties to their owner, the captain, Roger Penske, who joins us now as we continue on Lunch Talk Live. Roger, it is so good to see you. How are you giving us all a sense of what's going on? Because you go beyond the sports world with the incredible Penske company and corporation and all the industries you're involved in. So you're seeing this on many, many different levels. What's your reaction to what we're all going through as a country right now?
Well, Mike, first, let me thank you for letting me be part of your sports show today. I think it's great what you're doing for the sports world, really, from the standpoint of these shows. From my perspective, with some 60,000 employees around the world, you know, obviously, my first job is to be sure they're healthy and they're safe. And I've really been maintaining that connection here for the last several weeks. But from a business perspective, people are working from home. We have technology today, obviously, which is terrific. So we're having video conferences. I was on with Australia last night and early this morning on with Italy. But to me, we need to keep America rolling. I think at the present time with the individual states and cities and different disciplines on these lockdowns really is creating somewhat of a economic pressure for us. But I think we need to listen to the doctors, and certainly a lot of people are here deciding what is going to be the next step from the sports world. You've seen us move the Indianapolis 500 into the end of August. You've seen the Masters move into sometime in November. So what we have really is a rolling platform here today, and I think every day we're going to get smarter. But as Americans, we got to pull together during this terrible time.
You know, we were talking about this just before we came on the air. You've been around for a long time. You've seen a lot in your life. And one of the issues here is that none of us have ever seen this, and we don't know a playbook or history to lean on to figure out how we get back to whatever a new normal might be?
Well, I think that we really got to think about our families, our friends, and our team members first. Obviously, I think that's what I see everyone talking about. But more realistically, small businesses, entrepreneurs who have their own little business. These are people that I'm concerned about as we go forward. These are the sports fans. These are the fans that stand by the fences waiting to get autographs from great athletes. And we want to be sure they're back and they're healthy and they can come back to this great sports world.
Well, part of the Penske empire is now IndyCar, the entire industry, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. 1 year ago from right now where we are, Roger, here in April, did you have any sense that IMS and IndyCar would be part of the Penske Sports platform?
Well, I think last April I was thinking about the Indianapolis 500 that we're going to compete in the month of May, you know, obviously. But when you think about January 6th, when we took over the stewardship of the Speedway and IndyCar, I had no idea what I was going to face or our team was going to face as we go forward. But I think when I step back, I made the right decision. No matter what happens, the outcome of this pandemic from the sports world and certainly IndyCar. But to me, it's really a generational race. The governor, the mayor of Indianapolis, the town of Speedway have reached out to me and our team from the very beginning. And I think the most important thing is here we're operating as a team. And to me, we're going to get through this. We've established a race date with NBC late in August. It's my goal to try to have that race, the same pageantry, the same worldwide audience, and provide our fans with the best race ever. And to me, it's going to change. We're going to know the other sports will take place earlier, but we think we want to have the race as it was last year, the Indy 500 in August.
I had my first chance to be there on race day last year, and I'll never forget, Roger, sitting on the grid to host the pre-race show with Danica Patrick, and to be able to look around and see the 200-plus thousand people, it was overwhelming to me, and I've been to so many big sporting events. I'd never seen anything like that from that perspective. You have been going to Indy for generations, going back to the early 50s as a fan. What is it about your love for Indy that led you to buy the place, essentially, and take over the entirety of IndyCar as a sport?
Well, I think I kid people and said I owned the track inside, and now I could own the outside. No, this is a joke, really. But to me, you know, we've owned speedways before, certainly Michigan, California we built. So it's in our DNA. Obviously, we operate the race at Belle Isle. And to me, it was something that it's in my DNA. My dad took me to the Speedway back in 1951 as a young man. Maybe that's when I got injected in racing. But there's something about it when you walk in that track. And I was standing down in the first corner here a month or so ago and just looking at that track with nobody there. And ironically, today as we're talking, Breanne Leith, a young woman in the police force of Indianapolis, who was shot a week ago. And we're having a great ceremony, over 1,000 police cars at the track today. So that just shows you what it means to the city and the state and the people there. I'm so happy that we could provide the Speedway for this. So I just think it's an honor, and our family, it's an honor for us and our whole people to be able to be part of the track now and in the future.
And the things that you are doing around the track for fan experience, for the folks who've been to Indy in the past, when you go back, you're going to see a different atmosphere, a different environment for the fans. Let me ask you about iRacing, because obviously that has gotten some attention here over the last month or so. What have you learned in watching how the drivers and the fans are consuming this iRacing?
Well, I think iRacing, in fact, we have six events. You know, we've had three now, and we're going to have our fourth. To me, it's been great to see a lot of these young drivers are really doing a better job than some of the old pros. And I was really happy to see my man from Australia, Scott McLaughlin, have a chance to run these races, because hopefully he'll have a chance to join the IndyCar series in the future. But what he's told me, this helps him to understand how these drivers drive. He learns the track. So to me, the fans love it. We're getting good viewership on the iRacing. And to me, it's a way we stay connected, you know, with our fan. It gives the team something to do. And again, it keeps the sport on top of people's mind.
Yeah, Simon Pagenaud won last week the iRacing event that was held at Michigan, in theory. And his wife brought in some champagne to help celebrate. So if you're going to do this, you got to do it the right way. You might as well celebrate the victories, which he's become familiar with over the years. It's just kind of a neat twist to this. So I'm just curious, your exposure, obviously, in NASCAR as a strong team owner, and with the involvement we just talked about with IndyCar, and having a weekend where we're going to see both disciplines together at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, is this a chance to reinvigorate racing by getting fans from IndyCar and NASCAR back together to enjoy just racing?
Well, I think I've known Jim France and the France family for a long time. We were partners, in fact, at one point when we built California Speedway. So I reached out to Steve Phelps and to Jim to talk about what we could do to potentially make these weekends better. And this week came up with this idea of running an IndyCar race on the Brickyard weekend. And I think you're going to see more of that. I think it's a fan experience, and I think it'll be very, very good from a TV perspective to see the different disciplines. So I would hope that this is just the start of things that we can do together as we go into 2020 and beyond, because, you know, obviously NASCAR's got a great fan base, and we'd love to be with them on certain weekends and vice versa. We need to be sure that we can bring motorsports back to where it was prior to this pandemic, and I think that's job one from the standpoint of not only NASCAR, but certainly IndyCar and our team.
Last question. You have accomplished so much. A lot of folks with the level of accomplishment you've had would kick their feet up and go out and just enjoy what they've accomplished. Why do you continue to drive so hard still at this point in your life?
Well, I've said this is my fishing trip and golf game, you know, going to the races and also running my business. I've got 60,000 team members that I try to lead every day, and I try to lead by example. And to me, I've got a great family. My wife is really my crew chief, and my 13 grandchildren, 5 children. To me, they know this is what I love, and I want to keep doing it as long as I can.
Well, when the Super Bowl was in Detroit in 2000, Roger Penske was in charge of the organizing committee, and man, I got a chance firsthand to see what it's like to be a small part of the captain's team. When Roger Penske's involved, you know you're going to do it the right way. And he did that. He's done it every sort of way in racing, so many disciplines of racing over the years. Pleasure to visit with you. Glad you're well. Best to your family and all of Team Penske. And we hope to see you at the Brickyard later this summer.
Mike, thank you. And what you're doing for all sports, thank you very much for this time.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Roger Penske, the great Roger Penske, joining us here on Lunch Talk Live. When we come back, we've been talking about how it's Olympic week in America. David Bedaya is with us. Gold medalist going to join us, talk about what he's up to, what the plans are for next year when we come back. Three-time Olympian is David Bedaya, including 2012 Olympic diving gold in London. He also has a silver, a couple of bronze medals, hopeful for 2020, which is now pushed back to 2021. He'll turn 31 here in a week or so, and David Bedaya, American Olympic gold medalist, joins us as we wrap up Lunch Talk Live today. So, David, Olympic Games weekend, continuing with, we look back at London, 7, 9, 11, and midnight for the men's diving. So can I count on you staying up on NBCSN tonight to go back in Olympic Games week and watch your gold medal performance from 2012?
It depends on what the three kids look like upstairs, whether I'm up or not. I might be up all night. Who knows?
How old are the kids?
I have a 5, 2, and a 1-year-old. So they keep us very busy.
Thus, the books over your left shoulder. I was wondering if you're going to just pick up and read us a kid's book here as we go off the air. We're going to take an afternoon nap. Maybe you got a book in there that you'd like to read. It is a different life and a different lifestyle right now. What would you be doing right now if we were on course in 99 days from the Tokyo Games?
I would actually be in Tokyo right now doing our Olympic test event, trying to qualify the United States and diving to qualify for the Olympic Games. And, you know, it is different. It's a different time for all of us. But you look at the end of the day, this is not about just one person or one athlete or even one nation. This is a global epidemic. And so we're just trying to do what we can at home and keep everyone safe outside of our home.
David, when I talked to a bunch of Olympians, when we found that the postponement was going to happen that day, a lot of them were full of uncertainty, not knowing when to start preparing and what to do, not knowing when the Olympic Games would be held. Once you found out that it was essentially pushed back almost exactly a year, did that help you reschedule in your mind what the next 13, 14 months were going to look like?
Yeah, you know, initially, athletes, you look at this and it's daunting. You've trained extremely hard the past 4 years, and for us to be pushed back another year, it just seems all that work you've done, now you do another 15 months of that. It was overwhelming at times, but at the same time, at the end of the day, there's a blessing to it where what are the things that I did on my off season that I couldn't get to? And what can I do now planning forward for the next 14 months that's going to get me to where I want to be now in Tokyo 2021?
How has the transformation for you from platform diving to springboard diving, how has that gone and how comfortable are you in this discipline now?
It was different. I'm used to jumping off a three-story building, 33 feet up in the air, and transferring to a three-meter springboard. It puts a little spin on things, but the transition was smooth because I dove it at Purdue University for NCAAs. And I'll have to say, Mike, the next 14 months has kind of helped add some motivation where I can get that much better. Since I just switched to it right after the Rio game. So the more time, the better. But we'll see what looks like, 2 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, and then, ultimately July of 2021.
That's great perspective because you can use this time to just build more and more muscle memory, if you will, on the springboard. Well, we look forward to going back to watching your London gold medal tonight. If the kids are up, great. If not, you can sneak down at midnight and go back and watch it. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to watching what goes on the next year, and hopefully we'll see you in Tokyo in 2021.
Hey, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
And we for certain will see David Bedaya coming up tonight on Olympic Games Week here on NBCSN. This is what we do every day for you. Rich Eisen Show follows if you are watching us live. If you are not, then you're watching us at 3 Eastern. Remember that Hockey Happy Hour and all the fun stuff happens a little bit later on. Doug Marone, Danica Patrick, Jay Monahan, the commissioner of the PGA Tour, join us tomorrow. The Rich Eisen Show is next. Thanks for watching, and we will see you tomorrow.